Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, spring is here, and those warmer temperatures of spring bring many insects. And some will pollinate flowers. They provide food for other animals. Others can be a nuisance. They might defoliate your trees or damage your garden or do some things around the house. And we'll talk about all of that with Phil Pelletieri. Phil's an entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Hard to believe it's been that long. You can join the conversation with your insect questions. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Ah, nice to be here.
Let's talk ants to begin. You know, the temperatures rise, the ants come out of their, they have a dormant winter storage stage, don't they?
Yeah, but it's temperature dependent. And so when I would get calls about the first ant in the house, it depended a lot what time of the year. If you see an ant in early March, it has to be nesting in the house. I mean, it's just too cold outside. We're late enough now that the ants in the ground and out in the trees are active. So that's usually was my first question, you know, aside from what the ant looks like, is when do they first show up? Trying to decide, is it evidence of them nesting indoors, or as I said, are they just wandering in from outside?
Yeah, and in my experience, it's usually the kitchen.
Well, I mean, it makes sense in that, you know, ants either are protein or sugar feeders, and that's where they find the most food. And they do have that pattern that if they find food, they can put odor trails that attract other ants from the colony. And so it gets to be a very predictable pattern. And even if you clean up, it's hard to clean up to the point that they stop coming in, at least for the first few days.
Yeah, you know, I have an Energy Star home, you know, which I think is pretty tight. But still, they managed to get in.
Well, the critters are so small, and they're so adept at getting into little seams you don't know about and then weaseling through the walls and the like. It really is quite amazing. But I don't think anybody could have a house so tight that the ants couldn't get access.
Which species of ants in Wisconsin are, let's say, the most worrisome?
Well, the carpenter ant gets the most press, and, I've always tried to explain to people that they don't eat wood for a living, but they nest in wood that is soft and rotten, and that's what they'll excavate. So when the windowsill goes to pot, you find the ants there, the people would tend to blame it on the ants rather than realizing it was a moisture problem and a rot problem first. And for that reason, as I said, it's not that it doesn't point out you've got an issue, but as far as like termites where they eat wood for a living, it doesn't work that way at all. And so carpenter ants get, I think, the most concern. And I can argue if you've got trees on your property, I can probably find carpenter ants. I mean, they are everywhere. And it's only when the pattern suggests that they're in the house and where they're in the house. It might suggest you've got a bad board in your roof or something like that. And that's what really needs to be addressed.
Yeah. What about winged ants? Most ants don't fly, but winged ants do. How do you tell the difference between winged ants and, let's say, termites?
Well, there are winged termites. Now, termites and ants, when they are winged, they are reproductives, kings and queens, if you want to put it that way. And so in the case of ants, they have a constriction between their thorax, where the legs and wings are, and their abdomen. It's like a pinch. That's not the way it is in termites. Their abdomen is just straightly attached. Termites tend to be lighter in color, although there are some light-colored ants. We don't see many termite swarms, the winged forms, in Wisconsin. We do have termites scattered throughout the state. Not very common, but where they are, they've been for a long time. And as I said, it was interesting. Usually I would not get calls about winged termites in the house. Once in a while, somebody would find a board that had termite evidence, and then we'd go down that road of that you've got a termite infestation. The other thing about ants is after, let's say, the queen carpenter ant mates, she rips her wings off, and so they're not there anymore. Now, she's larger than the average worker ant, and if you looked at them under any magnification, you would see the wing stubs, so they are visible. But ants come out in wing forms together. We call that a swarm. And that's a dead giveaway of where the ants are nesting. Different species of ants nest it, or swarm at different times. Carpenter ants in the spring, field ants in the fall. And so, as I said, when people would call, that's one of the things we try to determine what time of the year, because it would kind of suggest what ants are possibilities.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, let's take a look at tent caterpillars. I think the eastern tent caterpillars probably starting to appear in trees, maybe in southern Wisconsin at least.
Yeah, it should be. So usually the eggs, which have overwintered as kind of a, it almost looks like a piece of tape or glue on the branches, hatch about the time the trees leaf out. So we're just getting there. The thing about it is that eastern tent caterpillar is primarily a flowering fruit tree problem. So, you know, cherries, apples, those kind of things. And the earlier you get to the nest, the easier they are to physically destroy. And so, you know, if you wait until the end of May when they're already done feeding and whatnot, they're very visible, but they've already done what they're going to do. So, again, if somebody's had a history, just when the trees start to leaf out, it's well worth going out and looking. And most of the time, it'll be a little webbing that isn't much bigger than a half dollar or so. And if you destroy that, you've taken the nest out.
And how do you – so that's probably the best way to control, or how do you – if you
– yeah, you know, it's always relative. If you've got a big cherry tree and there's one 20 feet up, there's no reason to bother. And the interesting thing, I think a lot of people, when you're driving, you know, in later in the year down the highway and you see those flowering fruit trees in the fence rows, it's very visible because they can be 100% stripped. What people don't realize is that that tree will leaf out again. So it really isn't a life or death matter for the tree at all. For a fruit tree, the argument is that you're pulling enough energy out of it, and the tree is going to have to throw more energy into new leaves, and so that will affect fruit production. So it's not that it's totally harmless, but it really is relatively – it's more a visual effect. And as I said, I think that's what gets people's attention.
And I think that they sometimes get, I think, mistaken for maybe fall webworms, maybe spongy moths.
Yeah, you know – fall webworm makes tents in a bigger variety of trees, usually in the end of July all the way into early September. There's also, in the northern part of the state in particular, there is a forest tent caterpillar, which likes to feed on popple and oak and a few other things. And interesting enough, it doesn't even make a tent, even though it's closely related. Spongy moth, what used to be called gypsy moth, is a critter that doesn't make a tent. And that one usually gets people's attention when the trees are already stripped and these relatively large, compared to a tent caterpillar, larvae are crawling around. They have five pairs of red dots and six pairs of blue dots on their back. And so they're really quite distinctive if you look on the internet for a picture of one. And so, yeah, anytime you get defoliation, and we got sawflies, and we got all kinds of critters that kind of gang up on plant leaves. And so it's well worth taking a look close enough at the critter to see if it matches the description or it turns out to be some other critter.
Let's go back to ants for a minute because we got an email from Joe. How bad should we let an ant infestation get in the home before enlisting perhaps a pest control service?
Well, a couple things. You know, you can solve most ant problems if you can bait them. Now, that's sometimes easier said than done because ants either have a sweet tooth or a protein, and you've got to get the right baits, and you've got to continue to provide it. The argument with that is that they pick up the bait and bring it back to the nest and kill the queen, which is the only member of the colony that can reproduce. So that's how you solve an ant problem, is either find the nest, treat it, or you bait them. As far as calling professional help, it's relative. You know, the professionals are fine-tuned enough in most cases to know what ant they're dealing with, so they make the right selections and choices. Should they spray the outside foundation? Should they use baits? If I've got sawdust coming out of a windowsill, that just needs to be spot treated. I mean, sometimes the ants, we want the ants to give their nest away, because as I said, it's very easy to control if you can find out where the nest is. And there are do-your-own products. The one thing, though, is that it's worth doing some homework rather than shooting in the dark here as far as control. And that's, again, the thing about if you know what kind of ant it is, it would both give you some hints on what kind of bait or indeed where they might be coming from, which tells you when you can treat. One of the standard ways of treating ants is to treat the outside foundation. And it, in many cases, does not solve the problem, but it stops the ants from coming in, which in itself is what people are after. There are some products, you have to do a little bit of legwork to chase them down, that honestly the ants can walk through and take back to the nest. Those can be applied either professionally, or you can go to do your own pest control services and buy some of these products. The thing I like about that strategy is you're treating the outside, not the inside. So there's less exposure to people inside. And, you know, some of these treatments, honestly, one treatment on the foundation will last for a whole year, which is really quite phenomenal. And again, if you don't feel comfortable with chasing that stuff down, you can hire professional help and have them apply that kind of service for you.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have Phil back. And if you have an insect question or maybe an experience to share relating to insects or maybe even an ID, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk to Nick Anich of the DNR about the progress that's been made on the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2. That's at noon. Right now, we're taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. Great to have Phil back. And you can join in with your questions about insects or maybe your experiences. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us, and the email address talk@WPR.org. Before we go to the phones, I want to go back to spongy moths for a bit, Phil. I think 2023 was a record bad year in Wisconsin for spongy moths. How likely is it similar to the outbreaks that we've had in the last year or two?
Yeah, I'm expecting things to moderate quite a bit. One of the best natural controls is a fungus disease. In order for this fungus disease to be effective, we need a wet spring. And we definitely had a wet spring in a good part of the state last year. When that happens, the caterpillars pick the fungus up and die. And so I think there was a marked reduction. The other side of the story is if we have two or three dry springs in a row, the other side goes, the populations explode. So it's a little bit predictable if you use that as a handle and measuring it. And as I said, my evidence of what's been going on is that the population should be down this year compared to what they were last year, and definitely from 2 years ago.
Yeah. And the DNR is still using aerial spraying to protect the state forests from spongy moths?
Well, only, you know, parts of the state where it's considered totally established, it's kind of like you give up. It's in, and so it's really been limited. I'm not even sure that they're identifying any sites. They continue to shrink, because spongy moth pretty much has been found in every county in some degree or another. Now, again, in certain cases when populations were high, you know, municipalities and whatnot can look at potentially having an aerial spray. But the interesting side of it is that, you know, you get a bad year, everybody is concerned, and then all of a sudden the weather changes, and next year you don't even need it. It's kind of hard to predict, and unless we had a 3 or 4 dry years and it looks like, you know, all heck was going to break loose, I really don't think that's very viable. I mean, they used some confusion techniques and other things. It wasn't all just insecticides. But as I said, when you look at the slow march through the state, we lost that war a long time ago.
Gene in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Gene.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
This time of year, tiny little bees come out of tiny little holes in my yard and swarm all over. They don't bite, but I'm not sure what they are or what I should do about them.
So there are lots of spring, what we would call solitary bees, and what that means is it's not a nest with a queen and a bunch of workers, but you can have a lot of solitary bees in one area. And so most of these are pollen-collecting critters that put their pollen on the ground, lay their eggs, and then the bees develop that way and emerge in the spring. Very important spring pollinators. Some have stingers, some don't, but you know, generally with wasps and bees, what I tell people is if it's a true one that lives in a nest, then they often are defensive if the nest is threatened. But this is not a nest, and so they're really very docile creatures. And you could probably argue that, you know, just let them be because they're good to have around. If people absolutely insisted, it's more changing the environment. But honestly, the kind of things you do is, you know, compact the soil and whatnot, which would keep the bees away, isn't good for plants. In fact, you can argue the other side is the bees are probably beneficial in the sense that they're helping aerate the soil naturally, aside from other things. And it's usually only a 2 or 3 week period of time that they're active at all, and then they're gone till next year. And so, as I said, it's more once you understand that they're really not a threat, I think most people are comfortable with leaving them be.
Yeah. Gene, thank you for calling. Asia in Viroqua, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm calling because I moved into my house last spring, and I had a big, blossoming, gorgeous tree that seemed to die off pretty early, and it seemed like there was a ton of June bugs, and I kind of researched it a little bit last year to see how I can address that, and it seemed really overwhelming, like I would have to treat my whole yard in order to save this tree. And I'm just wondering if you have any advice for the amount of June bugs that I seem to have.
And what kind of tree did you have, by the way?
It was a big blossoming tree, so maybe like a crabapple or something.
Okay. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of different critters that we call June bugs. There's a European chafer and whatnot. But the bottom line is two things. Even though they talk about the grubs are in the ground feeding on lawns, I would argue that in 99% of the cases, the critters that are bothering your tree are not breeding in your yard. Now, if there's so many grubs in your yard that they're killing the turf, that's a different story, but that really is a very unusual thing. The average species of June beetle in Wisconsin has a 2 or 3 year life cycle, and they have peaks. They come out real high numbers sometimes, and then you don't see them for a considerable period of time, and they're flying in at night. So, worst case scenario, you have a bad year, they eat all the leaves off. I'm hoping that the tree did at least leaf out after they did it, or did the tree stay very barren and thin?
It seemed to kind of just die off. Like the blossoms were beautiful and it was gorgeous, and then progressively it just seemed to drop its leaves way sooner than I would have expected.
Okay, so I think something else is going on. I mean, it almost sounds more disease-like. The thing about June beetles is they are a chewing insect, so they'll chew the leaves right off in worst-case scenario. And they do that at night, and during the day you don't see a whole lot going on. But if you've got leaves that more wilt and just, that sounds more like a vascular disease or something similar that is strangling the tree. What will tell you a lot is what happens in the next 2 weeks. I mean, either the tree's going to have the strength to throw some blossoms again and leaves. If not, as I said then, unfortunately, I think it has maybe even a life-threatening disease involved. The one thing about that, if that indeed is the case, there was nothing you could do anyway. I mean, there's no curatives per se in most of these cases when a tree has a vascular disease problem.
Yeah. There you go, Asia. So keep a lookout and watch for blossoms, I guess, and hope for the best. Sam in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi there. I would like to talk about Asian beetles. We have lived in a home here for 11 years, and that was one of the most curious occurrences is all these wonderful ladybugs that showed up, and until I learned that they bite, and they come in thousands. So we still have trouble with this 11 years later. They come into the northwest side of our home, both upstairs and downstairs. That happens to be a three-season room and our master bedroom. And I just would love to know what to do. I prefer not to use chemicals. We've had the doors resealed. The windows are older, but I just can't figure out how to prevent them from coming in. I mean, we don't get thousands anymore. I think we've corrected the consistency of the ceiling around the door of the sunroom. But anyway, I'd love some thoughts about that.
So, you know, this is a relatively speaking recent phenomenon. We didn't start seeing the problem in the state until the 90s, and the big problem is what you say is in the fall, in the right circumstances, they come in by incredible numbers and not near the numbers that was in around 2000 in comparison. But, you know, if I tell somebody there's only 10,000, there used to be 100,000, that's still way too many critters in your house. Now, you've went the right direction as far as sealing things, but these things are incredibly adept. And what I get nervous about in particular is overhangs, roof vents, and those types of things. Because if something can get access, let's say, to your attic, it now has free rein to work through the walls, your light fixtures, those kinds of things, and get in. So it's interesting your comment on the side of the house, because typically where they tend to congregate is on the sunny side, so more typically south and west. And it's really crazy, because if you take the same house and you surround it with trees so it doesn't get direct sunlight, most of those people don't have an Asian lady beetle problem. But you have this beautiful house sitting up looking over a valley, you know, in the nice exposure. That is almost like a magnet, and you're drawing these things from a long ways away. And it all happens in the fall. Typically, the trigger is the first decent freeze in usually October, but could be November. And it's like you turn a light switch on, they start coming in. So you got one of two options. You either stop them before that. And again, you don't feel comfortable with sprays, that's fine. But there are sprays that can be applied to the outside if people want to go that direction. But the argument is the direction you're going is if you can build them out. And so, again, it's going to take a little noodling on your part. You've gone the right direction. But I would look and think about it. It doesn't take much of a seam in your overhangs or whatnot for them to squeeze and push through. And you know, if people would call me and say, you know, I only see them in the bathroom, I'd say, well, you know, I would check the bathroom vent fan to make sure it's screened well enough, because, you know, that's a pattern enough that there's got to be a one identifiable space. So, as I said, I would continue to go that way. You know, if you know somebody in construction who's really good at understanding these kinds of things, the little seams and other potential things you can adjust, that's really the best direction to go.
Good luck, Sam. Thank you for calling. Penny in Altoona, Minnesota has a question relating, I'm sure. Penny, hi.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Yeah, last week I'd spoken to someone that was on your show, and he said the Asian beetles were probably coming up from underneath the house wrap by the foundation. And what I was wondering was, is there a particular fairly safe chemical to use to spray that you would recommend over anything else? Because, you know, I'm grateful that we don't have spiders aren't what come in the fall the way the Asian beetles do. But, you know, they do drive me nuts. I vacuum them all winter long, and it kind of gets me kooky.
Well, you know, although they can come under, if I think about the way I watch them behave, I'm more nervous high than low. Because what you will see is they congregate and then they start crawling up. And that's when they, you know, depending on your siding, work underneath the siding if that doesn't fit tight. You know, that's why newer homes, when they use the house wraps and whatnot, often have a pretty good insect barrier versus older homes, if things can get the siding, there's just wall voids and they work through there. Now, as far as sprays, almost all the sprays now come from one family of chemicals. They're called synthetic pyrethroids. That's a synthetic version of the natural insecticide pyrethrin. But the reason they went synthetic with it is that natural pyrethrin breaks down in sunlight very quickly. The synthetic forms last longer. And so the various house sprays, whether they're commercially applied or you put, have these chemicals on. Relatively non-toxic to most animals, but fish in particular are quite sensitive to it. And honestly, cats are a little bit too, but you know, you're not spraying your cat. And the argument spraying your outside wall is about the least potential exposure. And if you apply it, again, you apply it where you tend to see them congregate. And so it's well worth, and you might have experienced it, when they start flying in the fall after that first freeze, it looks like a bee colony to me. I mean, there's just hundreds of critters in the air, but you try to pay attention to where they're landing and congregating, and that will often point to you where you've got to look to spray. And, you know, if you get this, don't put the spray on by, let's say, the 15th of October. I kind of argue, why bother? Because once they have access to the house, spraying doesn't solve anything. They're already in the walls, and you pay for that all winter long and now into the spring. And finally, we're late enough that they're leaving. And the argument now isn't worth spraying because, as I said, they're leaving. And so let them go. You know, I wish more companies would provide the kind of suggestions for physical adjustments to some of these things. But to be fair to the pest control people, they're coming at it from a different direction. I mean, they're used to controlling pests. They're not construction people. So this is an interesting one where sometimes, if you can find the right person, it's not the pest control person, but it's a person that really understands the weaknesses of most structures to see where they can either build it out for insects, and the same argument is for rodents.
Penny, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Does that help?
It does. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Patrick in Brule, Wisconsin. We go to you now. Hi, Patrick.
Hey there. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Awesome. Hey, well, I'm an avid trout fisherman, and I heard you're on the radio, and I always heard there's a myth that the Hexagenia hatch on the Brule River progresses up nightly up the river every day, because we only get to fish this hatch for 2 weeks out of the year on the Brule. I was wondering if you could dispel or prove that myth correct, and then why I only get 2 weeks on the Brule, but the Hex and the Brown Drakes come off in Ashland on Shawamigan Bay like crazy for like over a month and a half through July. So why is it better over there than on the Brule River itself?
Sure. Okay, so my first comment is I find people who are trout fishermen have a much better understanding of insect behavior than even a lot of entomologists, because you're paying so much attention. You know, I think what it comes down to is the nymphs in the water need a certain temperature and condition for them to emerge. And this is somewhat predictable in the sense that, of course, the farther north you go, the cooler it is. It might be a combination up in Ashland is you both have a bigger area, but a more diverse area. So what you're doing is you're stringing it out. And I think you could probably make the argument that conditions might be better for the hex populations in general there than it's other places. My old colleague, Bill Hilsenhoff, who was one of the first people, he was an aquatic entomologist that dealt with stream quality. I mean, that's what they were using, is insects as indicators of stream quality. And what you could find is as streams become polluted or become warmer or whatnot, you change. And in general, it changes the direction that you don't want to have if you want to keep trout around. You know, so pollution and warming waters and whatnot is the wrong direction. But as I said, I think what's going on here is more a microenvironment. You know, depth of water, clarity of water, all those things are variable enough to affect the microenvironment where the hexes are, and then, as I said, that adjusts when it goes. Now, these things have evolved that they all come out at once. I mean, that's done on purpose for mating purposes for the creature. And as I said, I just speculate. Now, the other possibility is there's more than one species of hex, and there might be some diversity there, or at least more than one species of mayfly that you can see. But, it's much easier to predict the emergence if you know the physical qualities of the stream than it is to look at the calendar, as you might know. And then that it just makes sense.
Patrick, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Finally, have some open lines at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. And we have some emails here. Daniel emailed to ask how many back-to-back weeks of near constant zero temperatures does it take to set back ticks and other critters used to moderating Wisconsin winters?
Boy, zero doesn't do it for me. You know, I've said on the show all along that, you know, things have changed dramatically in the last 30 years as the winters have become milder. We've mm-hmm. gotten things that weren't here before that have moved up. I don't even find 25 below is going to kill ticks. And the argument is that they're hunkered down so low in the ground, they've got snow cover and whatnot, so they're kind of insulated. You know, insects and ticks, you know, ticks are a different group of critters than insects, but they're all cold-blooded, and it's basically like you turn a light on and turn a light off. If the temperature drops below about 40 degrees, they just go dormant, and it just does not matter. Their bodies don't freeze. It's really quite an interesting phenomenon as far as the adaptations that they have. And so, you know, the other thing about ticks is that most of our tick species have a two-year life cycle. So, it's not like they can explode overnight, per se. They need the right conditions to line up for a period of time. You know, the only thing that I ever in my career saw was a major influence on tick populations was way back in the 80s when we had just one heck of a drought. And honestly, that knocked the living devil out of the deer tick population. I mean, it took a couple, 3 years for it to recover. And we often equated that just to the harsh conditions when the ticks were out there and being active. But the other side, I don't see, as I said, even if hypothetically you could get freezing temperatures in June, the ticks would tolerate that just fine and come out of it without much of a problem. The one thing that kills critters in general is a big shock. If you take something from 80 degrees and throw it in your freezer, you're going to kill it, but it's the shock of the temperature, not the temperature itself. And if you give it 3 days to adapt and do the same thing, the things survive. It's really quite interesting.
Dennis emailed to ask, are any ants considered to be pollinators?
I would think so, because the point is that some ants work the nectaries of flowers, so they're crawling around there. And the whole thing about pollination in most cases is the pollen sticks on insects' bodies, and then when they move to the next flower, they can move it. So although they're not looked at like moths and bees and some of the other things that are high on the list, I definitely think ants that affect the nectaries of flowers definitely could be considered potential pollinators.
Tom in McQuantico, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. quick question. What's up with the stink bugs? I mean, all of a sudden, it seems like over the last couple of years, there are more and more of them, and I have them. I don't know what they do. They're here all winter, too. So just was interested on what your thoughts are on that.
This is another new invasive, relatively speaking. About the time I was retiring, this was hitting the fan. The critter that's coming indoors is technically a brown marmorated stink bug. It's an Asian species that started in the East Coast and marched this way. And just like Asian lady beetle, their whole claim to fame is to crawl into structures, spend the winter, and then now that things warm up, they start moving out. And I will tell you that their populations in Wisconsin really never went as crazy as they did in New Jersey and Pennsylvania when they first got here, thank goodness. But as I said, if you find two stink bugs a day for 2 weeks, you're not a happy person. But you can look on the internet and see pictures of buckets full of them in people's houses back when this thing started to get rolling back in the 90s and the like. So same kind of story. You know, your defense is going to be in the fall of the year. If you can identify, look at all your vents to make sure they're screened with a fine enough mesh screen that critters can't crawl through. Look at your soffits and the like. Try to figure the pattern, although I will tell you, because I get them in my house, and I can't figure the pattern. you know, there's just not enough of them for me to say, okay, yeah, the problem's got to be over in the one bedroom. It doesn't work that way. And so they do get frustrating, and it's kind of like Asian lady beetle. If it finally gets to the point that it really is bothersome, your defense is outdoor treatments in the fall. And for this particular creature, a little bit earlier, you know, Asian lady beetle, I'd say you're okay by 15th of October. With marmorated stink bug, boy, I would want to have something on the house by mid-September because they do come in quite early.
Tom, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to an email from Elaine in Madison. She says, it seems like we've had fewer Japanese beetles in the past few years. Are we at the bottom of some bell curve for them?
Yeah, that's another one that, you know, professionally watching it hit the fan was incredible. And the same thing. So, you know, on the west side of Madison, probably the peak population was in early 2000s. There wasn't a birch tree or a flowering crab or whatnot that had a leaf on in my neighborhood. There were so many beetles. And I will tell you the populations now are not even 1% of what they were at that point. And it's one of those cases that when they first invaded, they went crazy. Now there are various diseases and the like that have moved in that have really limited their population. And I will tell you, last year in my backyard, I think I saw 6 adult beetles, which blows me away. Because I live 2 blocks from a golf course, and my colleague Chris Williamson, who worked with Japanese beetle, could find golf courses in Wisconsin that has had high as 50 grubs per square foot. And so you think about those, and those things fly for a mile or two, just the sheer potential numbers. And that's, of course, what I was paying for when they first established. But they're not like that. So the other side of it, though, is people that are just starting to see it, and there are parts of Wisconsin that they're just getting to. Unfortunately, it's going to be a number of year process for the population to keep coming. And again, much like we talked earlier in the show, you know, you will read some publications that say, well, they're coming from the grubs in your lawn and kill the grubs in your lawn. Don't bother. I mean, it's just that's not the case. As they said, I tend to see they fly in. And interesting enough, I don't know if I can tell you in my career that I have seen a lawn in Madison that ever suffered enough from Japanese beetles that needed to treat. Golf courses are a little bit trickier because the conditions are always ideal in the golf course. They're always watering the turf and whatnot, and that's what supports the high populations. In some cases, I do know they treat to try to protect things. But in general, as I said, it really has been nice to see that, aside from that initial wave and all the bother, because they were really the bug from hell, if you want to put it that way, on the amount of plant damage they would do because they're flying from 2 miles down the road. They're feeding on, you know, 100 different species of things, roses, you name it. And they do it for 2 months. I mean, it's just a misery trying to fight the fight. But as I said, I would always warn people, or not warn people, suggest that given a little patience, it's going to get better. And boy, that has been the pattern, at least for me. But, you know, now we're talking 20 years from when they first got here.
Speaking of some time back, Jeffrey emailed to say that in the 90s, in northeast Wisconsin, there were incredibly large hatchings of walking sticks. As a result, Jeffrey said they witnessed over a square mile of defoliated white oaks and blueberry bushes, or blackberry bushes. The insects were out at night climbing on everything to the point they were causing power outages. Has this happened since?
Well, we get it, but it really doesn't happen very often. I remember a population explosion in the Baraboo Hills, and this, again, probably goes back to about that far. And so it really is not common. In fact, it's interesting because there's many years you would, even trying, would have a hard press to find a walking stick. So whatever the phenomena is that allow their populations to go, and as he mentioned, they do feed on oaks, and so you can get defoliation. It's good that it doesn't happen every year because then it would stress the oaks enough that they can get into other trouble. Usually a one-year defoliation is no big thing. And as I said, it's been a long time since I've heard of outbreaks anywhere. And this is a native critter. You know, it's not an invasive. Usually native critters behave themselves better. That's just kind of the way the pattern is. So,
entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. You can join in with your insect questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about our book club book, The Killer's Terms, a novel by Kevin Kleisner, and we'll get a review of Earthfest on the UW campus, and then we'll talk about shoe repair with Dave Franks. Right now, talking insects with Phil Pelletieri, and Mary Beth in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a number of trees that are ash trees that need to come down. They have been victim of the emerald ash borer. And my question is, should I keep the wood or should I get rid of the wood and not have it broken up into pieces like wood chips, or should I just get rid of it completely so that I'm not spreading it all over the place?
So the biggest concern is if you were to ship the wood to places that do not have emerald ash borer present. There are some tricks. Of course, if you chip it, you kill what's there. But if indeed you burn firewood and the like, there is an option of treating the wood in a way that you would kill the beetles before they get a chance to emerge. You know, one of the common phenomena, honestly, is to consider tarping it in the summer because you can generate enough heat that would kill any critters that were in there. That is one of the options. The way ash borer works is once the tree's dead and whatnot, they can't continue to breed in it. So, you know, it's kind of a phenomena as the trees in decline and the like. And so I don't know how far along these trees are. But you know, you've got some options. And I said the only concern would be if you had a cousin on the other side of the state and they needed some firewood, you don't want them to take your firewood because that's, you know, as I said, there are restrictions as far as moving it. But, you know, it has spread to enough counties that it's pretty much the western edge of the state is the most concerned because pretty much the eastern side of the state and a good portion of the north, it's been established for quite some time.
So Mary Beth could just as well, could she use it then for as a mulch on her own property?
No. If you have it ground, that destroys critters. There's no way they can breed in mulch. They need basically logs. They're working underneath the bark. You know, technically you could peel the bark back. That's, I think, more bothering than most people are going to go to. But as I said, one of the tricks, if you're trying to hold it, is to consider treating the wood in a way that you're going to make the conditions. Anything that dries the wood out faster is going to prevent breeding from it. And in particular, again, the kind of temperatures you can generate if you know, a tarp is put over it and held tight to hold the temperatures and get it really heated up, that indeed should be able to kill them too.
Mary Beth, thank you so much for calling. Mike in Westby, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yes, the Westby area. We have thousands of Asian beetles that have come in, of course, and out by our garage area, there's piles of an inch or two thick where I've used a product, if I can say it, called Home Defense with a hand sprayer. It doesn't get them right away, but about the next day and for a week or two, they're dead. It gets them pretty well. But what we just discovered this week that I wanted to kind of share is you take, I think, about any kind of apple and slice it into just a very narrow little wedge and set it on the counter or in the window where there may be 50 or 100 of them in our old house every day. You get 25 to 30 crammed onto that little apple slice, and then we put it in hot water with dish soap and or any kind of a container with water and dish soap, and it'll drown them. And that's kind of interesting. You feel like you've gained something by putting some of those apple slices in the window, and it's absolutely polluted with Asian beetles.
Yeah, well, you know, that makes sense. So when they first got here, we had trouble even in orchards of them coming in enough numbers. Now, normally I don't think they're capable of eating through the skin, but all you need is a little blemish or something to open it up, and then they had free reign. So I've got pictures in my files of apples, you know, two-thirds of the skin off and Asian lady beetles crawling all around. What makes sense here is, aside from them having a fondness for apples, in the spring when they're waking up, they're hungry. And they're attracted to apples, and so that makes sense. You've got a great solution there for the ones that you weren't lucky enough to stop. And again, I think with the kind of sheer numbers you're dealing with, the realities are no matter if you kill 90% of them, there's still a whole lot of critters to bother you all summer, or I mean all winter and into the spring. And you know, it just and I still get calls like this, but it used to be far more widespread when they really were going crazy. You, unfortunately, are just in the wrong place because it sounds like they are staying very prolific. And again, they're seeming to find no problem finding your house in the fall.
Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mary and Shano, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a real problem this winter in my house with box elder bugs. They're everywhere. I can vacuum them and turn around and they're right back. And they leave these little red blotches all over, like I call it their poop or whatever. But how do I control these box elder bugs?
Yeah, so it's the same thing. We put all these critters in a group we call fall invaders. And box elder bugs come in September and early October and work up under the siding, and now they're waking up, and they're not smart enough to always figure out how they got in, and so they're crawling around. So this is a native insect that, it seems that dry falls give us the biggest problem. Much like we had talked about spongy moth, there is a natural fungus disease that kills box elder bugs. And so if we get decent rains all the time, they all get sick and die before they come in. But if you get, and we had a dry fall throughout the state, then you get these big numbers. And the good news is we're getting to the tail end of it. They're moving out. You're probably experiencing the worst thing that they can do is that their little waste spots, you know, you got to clean up, and you know, it's worth cleaning them pretty quick because honestly, they're protein based, and sometimes they can be a more significant stain than you might think, and the like. In the fall, you can kill them with sprays. And honestly, one of the things that works against them quite well is detergents and soaps. And there is something sold at the nursery stores called insecticidal soap. It's good stuff. It works. What's hard for me to tell you is if you just take soap off your counter, I'm not sure it's got the right stuff in it or not. I remember, and this is years ago on the show, Larry, somebody said that they tried Cheer, it didn't work, and then they tried some Ivory, and it did. Well, that's the difference in the soap chemistry. And as I said, so if you really want the soap revenge, I think buy the insecticidal soap because you know it's got the right stuff and the like. It's a contact kill on the outside. So you spray in the fall. But being a contact kill, that means you spray today. If they walk on it tomorrow, you got to spray them again if they're clustered. And so, like I said, your defense is kind of catching them on those sunny days when they're congregating and you can see them on the side of the house and then deal with them then.
Mary, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Another Mary, this one in Lake Geneva, emailed to ask, can we treat our yards to reduce ticks? Mary says they are frequently visited by deer.
Yeah, although, you know, what we tend to find is typical mowed yards, honestly, are a dry enough environment that the ticks don't do very well. You know, and it's relative. You know, if you live on a four-acre lot and 3 acres is woods, you know, that not isn't the average lawn, and I'd be more concerned that that's an environment that would give you trouble. There are commercial companies that will treat, but the only time I can justify it is if you have had a history of getting ticks in your yard. And what we find is you've got a couple options. The weakness is that interface between where you mow and where the long grass and where the ticks really like to hide, where they come out. In fact, again, you can look, and I know the people out east did quite a bit of this type of physical changing of their lawns to make it drier and more hostile to the ticks. And again, anything you can do to keep stuff mowed, open, dry is conducive for less ticks, whereas long grass, anything that holds moisture and the like, they tend to do better. And so, you know, sometimes they would put gravel in for mulch in some of their flower beds if they were particularly problematic. But I will say from hearing how bad it is out in Connecticut and some of those areas, I have not experienced those kind of populations in the average lawn in Wisconsin because it just, you know, I don't know if it's more humidity out there or what the conditions, but it just doesn't seem to be common. So as I said, I find it hard to justify spraying, but you can. If you spray, this is the time of the year, the spring, that you spray once, and one spray should take care of things. Most of the ticks that are on the deer are going to stay on the deer. They're feeding. They've got no reason to drop off. And again, if one were unfortunate enough to drop in your lawn, I'm not sure the conditions are right for them to have successful reproduction because I think it's too dry. It's too hostile.
Mary, thank you very much for that question. Let's see. We've got in the last minute here, Jen emailed. They've heard advice against cleaning yards or cutting last year's growth down to protect insects and their eggs. What's the typical conditions or outdoor temperature we should wait for before cutting back growth?
Boy, you know, it's so variable because there's so many different ways that insects kind of get through things. And I think what gets frustrating, you know, it's nice if you've got a remnant prairie or whatnot, you can just let be and let everything go naturally. What you find with, you know, dead grass in your flower beds and whatnot, as I said, I'm afraid if you let things go long, if you let it go another month, I think you're fine, that anything that's there is going to definitely be gone and moving on. It's just a question, can you tolerate that kind of stuff? And you know, most of us, at least my neighbors, have been pretty active last week cleaning things up and getting ready and going. And you could make the argument that it's better to do that in the spring than it is in the fall. But on the other side, I'm not sure we're gaining as much as you might think. As they said, it's early. Things are just starting to wake up now. I will continue for the next couple, 3 weeks to become active.
I think I'm the only neighbor in the neighborhood who hasn't yet cleaned up his front of his yard. Phil Belletieri, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good, Larry.
Phil Belletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the Breeding Bird Atlas 2. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and now we're taking some time to talk about the efforts to document the birds who breed in Wisconsin. It's a years-long project, and it's resulting in the publication coming fairly soon of Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2. We'll get an update on its progress from Nick Anich. Nick is conservation biologist with the DNR and coordinator of the Atlas. Did you read the first edition? Do you wonder about the new volume and what it will reveal about the state's birds? Join in with your birding questions at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Nick Anich, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I was thinking back about this show, and I remembered interviewing Sam Robbins, Noel Cutright, about the first Breeding Bird Atlas. And yeah. It was a lot of excitement. And that was, I don't know, I suppose the mid-90s or so.
Yes.
And now here's Breeding Bird Atlas 2, which is really exciting. First, when do you expect it to be published?
We're hoping 2026 here. But yeah, I mean, so the field work for Atlas 1 ran from 1995 to 2000, and the field work for Atlas 2 ran from 2015 to 2019. We had over 3,500 citizen science surveyors, resulting in a data set of 2.8 million records. So that's why it's taken so long. We have 250 different species that breed in the state, and each of those will have two pages in the book with a species account and maps of occurrence and change and abundance and whatnot. So it's a big project, to be sure.
Yeah, and covering a fair number of years and in pretty specific areas. Talk about how that information was collected.
Yeah, so back when they started the first atlas, they gridded up the whole state into 3 by 3 mile grids, and they tried to cover about 1,200 of those well. And so when we did the second atlas, we went out and did the same thing. And so you send people out, and they go out a number of times in the spring and the summer and walk around and try to get into all the habitats and come out with an idea of all the species that are nesting in one spot.
And why is
and
it?
So, you know, yeah, you have a really good comparison with the 2 years. You get 20 years apart. We got these two time periods. And then you can look at, change. Is this species in the same range that it was 20 years ago? Or are we losing it, or is it shifting? So we've got really good comparisons.
Will this edition look quite a bit different from the original? Or it sounds like at least you're covering the same areas.
Yeah, so this book is going to be a hair bigger, both in dimension and pages, probably. We'll have the advantage this time around of having that change map where you can visualize the change in range between the two species. But yeah, I mean, if you're familiar with Atlas One, it is like a textbook-sized book that covers all of Wisconsin's breeding bird species. So, I mean, I think it's really cool.
It must have been fun. I mean, you've been working on this project since 2015, I think.
Yep. Yeah, it's been a process for sure.
Oh, man. Organizing all of the people and then collecting all the data and organizing that data, those data, it's got to be a mammoth.
Yeah, you know, back when they did Atlas One, it was kind of before everybody was on their computer. And so, like, they were doing paper cards, paper survey cards. And so Atlas One ended up with about 250,000 records. And we were using eBird, which is this free online program. You can put in your records on the web, or you could do it on your phone. And So it's a great system, but it did result in 2.8 million records, hence the long data vetting process we had to go through.
Yeah, and it is what we would call a citizen science project.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we had a lot of dedicated people that we could not have accomplished this without, for sure. And, you know, eBird is a great thing for people to use, you know, to keep track of the birds in their yard or their park, or, you know, the hardcore birders are out there, you know, doing day-long migration counts and documenting rarities and stuff. The challenge with eBird data in general is, you know, the really good birding spots in the state and the populous areas are very well covered. The advantage of doing it this atlas, where you had to grid out a very specific study design, is we got a lot more coverage in the rural areas that might not even see that many birders in a given year.
Who, you know, as you think about the book, who do you think is going to get the most out of the book?
Well, I think we're kind of aiming at a couple audiences. One is we want it to be accessible to the general public. We want people who think birds are neat to be able to learn about the birds in the state. So we're trying to write it, you know, not over anybody's head. But another audience is definitely, you know, wildlife managers. And, you know, we're looking at some big picture analyses. Birds are a pretty good study animal to study the environment. You know, some birds are generalists, but most birds have a very specific habitat that they like. And so, you know, I think we can translate a lot of these changes that we're seeing into real environmental change. And in addition, we can prioritize conservation. So, I mean, this analysis has really looked at some of the groups of birds that are winners and losers, and that is really going to be determining the attention that we give these species down the road.
Several email questions here. The Greater Wisconsin Birdathon started yesterday and continues until June 15th. This event is Wisconsin's largest fundraiser for bird conservation. It's hosted by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. And similar to Walkathon fundraiser, participants record bird sightings for pledges instead of miles logged. Do the data collected during the birding events make its way to you and get incorporated into the atlas?
During the atlas fieldwork years, they did. I mean, I am running the Birdathon this year again. I run it every year with Ryan Brady and Eric Brunke, and we start at Ryan's house at 2 a.m. and go until dark. All around the Ashland and Shawangan Bay area. But yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about eBird is, you know, whether you're, you know, putting your garden in or taking your kids to the playground, like if you are seeing birds, you can plunk them into the system. So, you know, the Birdathon stuff goes in there, the dedicated surveys go in there, and the more casual birding goes in there.
Yeah, it's really cool. Michael emailed to say they've heard various viewpoints about the decline of nesting Connecticut warbler in Wisconsin. One emphasized loss of winter habitat. Another emphasized the cutting of trees where Connecticut warblers used to breed. What did the Breeding Bird Atlas Project find out about these warblers, and what were the conditions of the areas where they once bred?
That's a good one to talk about. Yeah, Connecticut is one of our biggest decliners, and that was kind of a situation that was put on our radar by the Bird Atlas. And so they are nesting in, like, black spruce swamps, and they're also nesting in older jack pine. And we saw a really, really sharp decline in the second atlas, so much so that in the couple years after Atlas fieldwork, we decided to do some follow-up surveys. And we actually went back to a bunch of locations that had birds, and we found hardly any. We actually finally narrowed it down to just about two stands in the Northwest that had these birds, and we were watching these stands year after year, and they went from about 10 birds to 5 birds to 4 birds to 3 birds to 2 birds to 1 bird to no birds. So that's without any obvious habitat modification on our end. So I mean, while it's true that, you know, some harvest of jack pine might be one cause of their decline, the fact that they vanished right under our nose without those stands being modified suggests migration or wintering ground issues. And we actually have convened a little working group here with our colleagues from Minnesota and Michigan and Canada to try to figure out what's going on with this bird. The few birds that they put trackers on and when they have a really long migration, they fly, I think most of them head east and then leave out of the eastern Canada and northeast United States and fly all the way across the Atlantic down to South America and go deep into South America, including a lot of these areas that are being pretty heavily clear cut. So I think that's kind of one of the things that we need to look at and hopefully get some South American partners on board here and try to figure out if bad things are happening to this species on the wintering grounds. They do seem to maybe be holding their own in some of the Canadian range, like Alberta. So they, you know, they can follow this spruce and jack pine up a little bit into the Canadian boreal where I think they're doing better. But on the south and east end of their range, they're doing pretty poorly. And I mean, I think northern Minnesota is probably the only place in the lower 48 where they still are.
Hmm. Owen in Cornucopia emailed to say they hadn't seen a red-headed woodpecker in 20 years, but one day, a couple of years ago, one showed up, and Owen was able to photograph it, and it is indeed, I'm seeing the photograph, and it's a red-headed. What do we, but Owen wonders, what do we know about red-headed woodpeckers in the state?
Yeah, I've had them on the South Shore there a couple times too. They tend to like kind of this oak savanna type setup. So, you know, you go a little south of Cornucopia into the Barrens there. They really like that sandy, oaky type habitat. They are one of our rarer woodpeckers, I think, but they can be regularly found in the right habitats.
Our guest today, Nick Anich, conservation biologist with the DNR and coordinator of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas II. Great to have him with us today. And questions about birds or about the Breeding Bird Atlas, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas II with its coordinator, Nick Anich, conservation biologist with the DNR. It's great to have Nick with us today. And again, you can join us. The number is 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Alexis emailed, are there similar atlases to this one concerning birds in other states? And if so, do authors of the volumes collaborate at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Minnesota just finished theirs a little bit ago and rolled it into a book and a website. Let's see, I think I'm trying to remember which ones are still going on. North Carolina might be still going on. Maine just finished. New York just finished. Maryland, D.C. just finished. Ontario is going on still, if you want to head up there. But yeah, so this is a thing. It's kind of standard to do these surveys about 20 years apart. It gives you really good data on a bunch of, you know, non-game species that might kind of fly under the radar otherwise. There was a North American Ornithologist Union meeting a couple years ago that atlases was one of the big topics. So I got to go and see all of these people I've been collaborating with on Zoom and Slack for many years. But yeah, we help each other out as best we can. There's kind of an informal group of us that is ready to lend each other a hand and give each other strategy and whatnot.
Christy in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks a lot. Say, we were out deer hunting November 23rd on Kerryville SNA, which is in the lower Chippewa River, just upstream from Durand. And we were seeing a flock of red-headed woodpeckers in that oak savanna there. I counted at least 14, and my nephews saw more. We were curious. It was a very happy flock, lots of singing, hawking insects from trees. Might they have been grouping up to migrate, or why so many? You know, it's so encouraging to see that many that DNR has had prescribed burns over the years in that oak savanna. Any thoughts on the large numbers in a flock?
Yeah, that is really good habitat for them, but they are more migratory than most of our woodpeckers. So, I mean, you think about our hairy or downy or pileated woodpeckers, most of those do not move too much, but redheads do migrate. So with a count like that, you very well could have been seeing some on the move.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool sighting there, Christy. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Land O'Lakes called, couldn't stay with us. Bob said they haven't seen purple martins in Vilas County for a long time and wonders why they haven't seen those purple martins.
Yeah, purple martins are declining in the north for sure. I'm up here in Ashland, and they used to be up here in a couple boxes, and it's been many years since they're up north. Purple martins are part of this group that we call aerial insectivores. You know, they swoop around and they eat insects primarily, you know, along with things like swallows and even like, you know, nighthawks and whippoorwills. That is a group that in general is declining, and people are a little bit worried about. I'm not exactly sure what the story is with purple martins, but I have read papers about, you know, insect populations in general declining and people being worried about that. So, yeah, you're not alone, and you're not imagining things. They have declined in the northern counties for sure.
We have some other emailers. I'll get to those in just a minute. I'm just wondering, you were talking about birds that are declining. There are some that are going the other direction. You had a nice chart showing those birds that have gone for the better and some that have gone for the poorer. And let's talk about maybe some of those that have we're seeing more of. I saw one, the highest was exotic birds.
Yeah. So if you talk about species that either have been introduced to this continent on purpose or that escaped, some of the big gainers, there's Eurasian collared dove, which kind of has been spreading through the continent starting in Florida. And I don't know if they're going to make it up into the north woods of Wisconsin, but they have spread across much of the continent. They're a little bit bigger than a mourning dove with a black collar on their on the back of their neck. They had a big increase during this atlas. European goldfinch and great tit are two European songbirds that we think were let go from a pet shop in Chicago and have settled into southeast Wisconsin. So, you know, between Racine and Milwaukee now, there's a fairly good-sized flock of European goldfinch. They're about the same size as our American goldfinch, but they've got more red on the face.
That's pretty interesting. And I was interested that birds of prey have increased.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we can thank things like, you know, banning DDT and some of these other environmental regulations. Peregrine falcons are doing great. A lot of these, like, power plants and skyscrapers are putting up nest boxes for them in big cities. A merlin, which is a smaller falcon, it had a pretty big gain. They are even pushing their range south a little into some of these conifers. They particularly like nesting in spruces in towns.
That's pretty cool. The number of hoopers and trumpeter swans has seemed to have increased as well.
Absolutely, and that's another conservation success story. People working to establish the experimental whooping cranes We're seeing those more and more. And then trumpeter swan, you know, they flew the eggs back from Alaska to introduce them here. And then it was kind of a slow start. They started out as a, you know, very secretive, well, like a remote lake type of situation. And all of a sudden they are everywhere. So yeah, if you're paying attention, you're probably seeing a lot more trumpeters in the state.
Rick in Stevens Point has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to affirm the benefit of the Breeding Bird Atlas. My wife and I were birding in Iverson Park in Stevens Point, one of our public parks, on Sunday morning. And there's some little forks of the Plover River that are channelized and through wooded areas. And we saw what was clearly a water thrush. But which water thrush, the northern or the Louisiana? So with the assistance of our eldest daughter, who's a big birder, we did a little research, including looking at the Breeding Bird Atlas to see coverage and occurrences and which of those thrushes that we thought it could be. And so it's great to have that resource available.
Oh, thanks so
cool.
much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The rule of thumb with water thrushes in general, and water thrushes are actually a warbler despite the name, is the Louisiana is more of a southern species that likes flowing water, and the northern is likes still water.
Interesting. What are people, you know, when they get their hands on the Breeding Bird Atlas, what are they going to find in it? I mean, and you can get this online as well, I'm guessing.
Yeah, all the maps are already online at ebird.org/atlaswi. The book we hope is a really cool, like, coffee table size book with great pictures. And, you know, on the one hand, we'll have kind of some big picture analyses talking about, you know, what's important for birds of the state in general. But then I think a lot of people are going to grab it and turn to birds that they see, turn to birds that they wonder about, you know, familiarize yourself. There's 250 breeding species in the state. So, I mean, even for people who know birds and love birds, there's lots to learn in there.
Maddie emailed, now that the research is done for the book, are there other citizen volunteer projects relating to birds to get involved in?
That is a good question. There's the Christmas bird count around Christmas time, which is always a good one. There are circles all over the state on that. There's the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which was alluded to earlier, which you can form a team and do a big day, or you can do I think they let you also do checklists all spring long. Or if you don't want to do the birding, you can support your favorite team. And then there's eBird in general, which is not a like super directed project. It is just kind of a way for you to record all the birds that you are seeing. And it allows you the flexibility to do that any way you want to do it, provided you're submitting the basics on, you know, date and location and whatnot. I would endorse all three of those things.
I would. And there are some other events that are coming up that a person could participate in and have some fun in and help the cause in the various areas. I know you're up by Ashland, I think, the Shawamigan Bay Bird.
Yeah, we have a Shawamigan Bay Bird and Nature Festival, and I think Green Lake has a festival. I know Wisconsin Society for Ornithology has a convention. There's a lot of different things to do in the spring. We are happy that spring is here and ready to take advantage of it.
I know Madison's Bird and Nature Festival is coming up quite soon, April 27th. So that's another way to kind of get involved with birding. And there's probably some more. I'm sure people will be calling and letting me know which ones I'm missing as we move along here. Lark sparrows. Did we mention lark sparrows yet? They're among some of the bird species that are on the rise.
Yeah. The last couple callers from the Eau Claire area, that is kind of the zone where a lot of these lark sparrows, they're kind of pushing in from the west. That was kind of a surprise to me. They really like kind of dry country, dry grassland and farmland and barrens. But yeah, that lark sparrow made a big push.
And going from the dry to the wet, the wetland birds have done pretty well.
Yeah, in general, I think with wetland protection, most of these wetland species are holding their own. There aren't too many severe swings one way or the other in that group.
Yeah. If you look at like the peregrines and the merlins are increasing, lark sparrows, as we just talked about, why do you think reproduction of these birds is improving? It probably depends on the species.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely depends on the species for sure. You know, we actually are partnering with a few folks at UW-Madison to take a closer look at some of these changes we're seeing and dig into, is it the landscape change? Is it the climate change? What is driving some of these changes that we're seeing? I would say in general, a lot of the birds that are southern species are moving north, and presumably some of that is climate related for most species. When you talk about the northern birds, it's more of a mixed bag. Some of those are retreating to the north and some of those are kind of holding their own. And complicating us examining this a little bit is the fact that if you have two atlas periods, it's a lot easier to find one record of a species in a new northerly block than it is to have every single last record on the southmost block blink out. So there's a little bit of bias in the data, but even beyond that, we're pretty sure that a lot of these species are shifting, you know, 10, 20 miles north since the last atlas. And we're going to be digging into more specific causes on that.
What are other species that were not seen or included in the first edition, but have been documented since?
We actually had 13 species that were newly confirmed breeders. I already talked about the three exotics, Eurasian collared dove, great tit, and European goldfinch. We have the two endangered species, whooping crane and Kirtland's warbler. We have a couple kind of very rare northern and western breeders, bufflehead and canvasback, two ducks that I don't think are necessarily going to be colonizing the state. Sometimes you just find one pair once, which is also at this point the case with some of these rare southern breeders. We had a glossy ibis at Horicon Marsh, which is basically an Atlantic coast breeder. That one was a big surprise. Mississippi kite, we had in far southern Wisconsin. King rail as a marsh bird we also had at Horicon. And then a few of these southern species are probably going to be slightly increasing, which include yellow-throated warbler, white-eyed vireo, and blue grosbeak. We had a handful of records this time. Atlas 3 will probably show a few more for those southern species.
You know, I was thinking about it. I used to live on Lake Monona in Madison, and I would see canvasbacks, and this is back in the 90s, and I would see canvasbacks, and I'd see buffleheads, for example. But how do we know if they're actually how do you determine that they're actually breeding in the state?
Yeah, so when we send people out to go do atlas surveys, they have a lot of guidance on one of the easiest things is timing. So if you see a canvas back in April, you shouldn't be very suspicious. If you see a canvas back in June, you should be more suspicious. But there's also a series of breeding codes, like the lowest breeding codes are just inappropriate habitat the right time of year or a singing bird the right time of year. But then the next step up is probable codes, like you saw a pair or you're suspicious that there's a nest. And then there's confirmed codes, like this one is sitting on a nest or a nest with eggs or fledged young. And so When people were going out above and beyond what you put into eBird regularly, we were having people tag these records with breeding codes, which was another fun thing to prove for 2.8 million records. we got there.
Oh, man. Of the sightings that I'm thinking about, those again that weren't seen in the first edition of the book but have since been seen, which of these new species sightings are you the most excited about?
I mean, I've been doing some work with Kirtland's warblers, so I would say that that species is probably near and dear to my heart. They are a species which, originally they didn't even know where they nested, and eventually they figured out that they nest in the lower peninsula of Michigan in a very specific age of jack pine. And historically, this was probably maintained by large fires through those barrens habitats. And, you know, as they studied Kirtland's warblers, they were keeping track of the population, and it got down to just only a couple hundred birds, and they were trying to figure out what was going on, and they eventually figured out that a lot of it was the habitat getting too old. Kirtlands are pretty picky about being in young jack pine, and another factor for them was these brown-headed cowbirds. Brown-headed cowbird is a native bird that will lay its eggs in other birds' nests, and so historically they followed the buffalo across the plains, and they didn't want to tend their own nest, and so if a cowbird slips its egg into your nest, then all of a sudden you're feeding a baby that in many cases is bigger than your own baby, and you, you know, have less reproduction as a result. But anyway, I'm trying to remember what year it was, maybe 2007. They found some Kirtland's warblers in Adams County in some young red pine. And ever since, we've kind of been keeping an eye on the situation. And now, you know, they really like the young pine, and they're really tied to these outwash sands or these barrens habitats. But we've had a few in Adams, a few in Marinette, and a few in the Northwest Sands, and a few in Vilas. And we are kind of quietly keeping an eye on this population, trying to encourage proper forest management. And but I saw that big ice storm just rolled through the lower peninsula the other week there, and I mean, if you've got a now the Kirtland's warbler is up to, you know, several thousand individuals, but you know, still, you know, you've got a relatively rare species. You got to be careful that they're hanging on.
Yeah. Well, Paul emailed, how accurate are the data that citizen scientists, like the data collected for this atlas, how accurate are those data, and how do we know?
This went through many rounds of proofing. The very first level of proofing is when you go to put something into eBird, you can't just say that you saw a flamingo in Madison. All of these lists are customized by region and by date. And so it's not going to let you report something totally outlandish. But we went through and we screened this every way we could think of. We screened by breeding code. We screened by date. We looked at the maps. We looked at the breeding codes by time of year. And so we actually spent about 3 years going through this species by species by method to try to whittle it down. And so I'm sure there's an error or two in there, but I don't think they're driving the pattern. I think, you know, it's clean enough, hopefully, now that the patterns we're seeing are real.
Sunny emailed to ask, which tern species do we have in Wisconsin and how are they doing?
We actually have a number of tern species nesting in Wisconsin. The rarest is Caspian tern, and it's the largest one. They nest on some islands in Lake Michigan, and last I heard, they got hit really badly by that avian flu. So this was after the Atlas. You know, people have heard about avian flu, and everybody always wonders if you should take down your bird feeders. From what I've heard, songbirds aren't really a concern, but larger bodies, birds, including waterfowl and a lot of these colonial nesters, could be a concern. Other tern species we have in the state include Forester's tern, common tern, and black tern. of those, I think black tern is kind of sliding the most. But all of these colonial waterbirds are, as a group, kind of having negative trends. And so, you know, they can be sensitive to water level change. They can be sensitive to the bird flu, as I mentioned. They can be sensitive to contaminants and water quality and stuff like that. So, you know, that those are definitely bird species that we want to continue to try to keep an eye on these colonies and see how they're doing.
Yeah, and Sunny had also asked, are stilts nesting in the state?
Yeah, that was an Atlas One surprise, or maybe even the year after Atlas One. But there's something called a black neck stilt, which is a kind of sandpiper that is black and white and really quite striking. And as the name suggests, they have kind of comically long legs. So they're like a medium-sized shorebird, and they're doing really well at Horicon. So if you go to Horicon Marsh in the summer, there's a good chance at you being able to see one there.
Yeah, you go to Horicon, you're going to probably see, 300 bird species?
Oh, yeah, that's quite the place.
This time of the year, and I actually think Horicon has a bird festival May 9th through the 11th, which is a dandy with,
I bet.
Opportunities to go by boat and with people who know what they're doing and among other things, and it's a chance to see a whole lot of birds. Mark in Wisconsin Dells will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. A week ago, I saw a pair of whooping cranes up at Woodstock, north of Richland Center. But I was wondering about owls. I saw a saw-whet owl in Merrimack a few days ago at about 3 in the morning, sitting in a mowed lawn, and it flew up in a tree. And I don't know anything about them or how abundant they are, but it's the first one I've ever seen in my life. And then this morning I saw an owl about 7.5 inches high, tall, sitting on a fence post. I think that was a screech owl, but I'm not sure.
All right, let's talk about owls for a minute here, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, 7 inches tall sounds about right for a screech owl. Owls are getting going this time of year. Many of them are kind of early nesters. Saw-whets are actually migrants. So some of these banding stations actually can catch hundreds of saw-whets. Saw-whets are probably more common than we think, but they're pretty nocturnal and pretty little. And so, you know, your best chance of seeing one is to randomly run into one hiding in a pine tree somewhere in the woods. But they're definitely out there, and we do have them breeding, you know, and I wouldn't say they're common, but they're, you know, regular breeders across the northern two-thirds of the state, probably.
Yeah, and we probably, I mean, great horned, we have lots of great horned, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, great horns get going really early. You can hear them calling to each other in January, you know, starting to set up the courtship. Yeah, great horned is relatively common, and barred owl, I would say, is the other fairly common owl, and those are bigger.
Nick Anich, our guest today, conservation biologist with the DNR and coordinator of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bird questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Nick Anich, our guest today. It's great to have him with us as we talk birds. Just to mention, tomorrow on the show, our book club book, The Killer's Terms by Kevin Kleesner, will be talking with Kevin. We'll get a preview of UW-Madison's Earth Fest, and then we'll talk about shoe repair with Dave Franks. That's tomorrow. Right now, though, we're talking birds. And again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk a bit more about the bird species that are dropping. Nick, American black ducks come to mind. Black-backed woodpeckers come to mind.
Yeah, so we already touched on colonial water birds and aerial insectivores as two groups that on average are declining. Boreal birds is a big one. And so, I mean, that could include black duck, blackback woodpecker, Canada jay, could include Connecticut, which we already talked about. A lot of these birds are associated with these coniferous habitats going up into the northern boreal zone of Canada. And so if you look at the range map for almost all of these boreal birds, it kind of peters out in the northern two or three tiers of Wisconsin. And so if you were going to expect that we were going to see climate-related changes, you would expect that we're going to see them right on the southern edge of that range. And that is what we're seeing in a lot of these species. For some of them, we're not exactly sure what it is that is driving this. A certain number of species have a lot of work done on them. One good example is Canada jay. They figured out that Canada jay they actually use their saliva to stick perishable food to spruce trees, which kind of preserves it. And so if they find a roadkill deer, they can go and rip little bits off and stick it to a tree in the bog. And then they are really early breeders, and so their young might be hatching out in May and April when there aren't a lot of good food sources out there, and they're using that cached food. But if it turns out that we have a really warm fall and we get some hot days in October when they think that their food is going to be in the fridge, you know, that can really ruin their food supply for the young the next year. And there have been some papers, I think, from Ontario that have really tied warm falls to really bad reproduction. And so that's just one example of a mechanism on how you might see warming temps harming some of these birds.
Yeah. James in Fountain City, we'll turn to you now. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks. Hey, you're commenting about migratory birds that are mostly southern located that are turning up here. A couple of years ago, well, maybe it's been 4 or 5 years ago now, I saw a couple of birds, ducks out on marshy area, and I'm an old duck hunter, so I know ducks up and down the line. I'd never seen them before, and I'm going, what in the devil, where are these things? Well, I did some research, and it turned out they're whistling ducks. Now, about a year later or so, they were a pair, were observed down near La Crosse or on Alaska out in the marsh. So I don't know if these are birds that are, because of warming trends, are kind of moving up this direction or not. But, yeah, they're pretty different to see. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Black-bellied whistling ducks are moving northward pretty rapidly. We don't see them very commonly in Wisconsin, but the La Crosse birds happened after the Atlas, so they're going to be a little footnote in the Atlas book, but we'd find young with them there in La Crosse, which was, I mean, 10 years ago that would have been just unthinkable, but every year now more and more are starting to creep up. They seem to be doing quite well and pushing north faster than we would have ever thought.
Yeah. James, thanks. Appreciate that call. Marie in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about an American goldfinch that appeared about 3 days ago at my hilarious bird feeder. It looked too fluffy, and it just plain looked sick. It would get inside my hilarious and eat food and get out and sit on the perch part of the feeder, and then it would fly away. It came back a couple of days in a row and has since then disappeared. I'm wondering if it had, like, avian bird flu, but I know it was sick. It's probably gone off and died. Should I dump all the bird food from my feeder and clean it out thoroughly?
Yeah, I think so. And so it's probably not bird flu. What we often see with finches like this is conjunctivitis. But if you observe something like that, the thing to do is to clean out your feeders and take a little pause on feeding. I think they often recommend you use some dilute bleach or something like that and just wash them out and let them dry. And then you know, wait for a week before you get back to feeding, because especially with things like finches with like to congregate, the main idea is you don't want the sick bird spreading it to others.
Megan emailed to ask where can they get a copy of the Breeding Bird Atlas, too. A quick internet search only brings up the first atlas, and of course it isn't published yet.
It isn't published yet. No, it will eventually be published with Penn State Press, which is the organization that has published the last four or five United States atlases. We will be sure. I will probably end up back here with Larry when we have can celebrate the publication of it. But yeah, we will try to push that far and wide, and we'll be very happy when that day arrives.
What in the meantime, though, you have some things posted.
Yeah, I mean, if you go online right now at ebird.org/atlaswi, you can find all the stats. You can look up your county and see what birds are in it. You can pull up a species and see where the range map is. You can toggle to Atlas One and see how that species has changed. So yeah, with all the raw data are up there. And for that matter, you know, we've had almost 50 different projects use the Atlas data already here. So, I mean, at Wisconsin DNR, we're using it for conservation planning in a lot of different ways, but I've had a lot of requests, you know, depending on what somebody has going on their property. Like, if there's all these different questions you could ask, and all this is statewide data, so you can pull it for your county or you can pull it like whatever you're interested in. The data is freely available for eBird for any application if you can think of a use for it.
Yeah, and just go to eBird. Well, how do you do that once more?
eBird.org is, and then go to the bottom, and there's a spot for you to download your data. And then it's got a special tag on it that identifies it as Atlas data.
Yeah, and we'll put that up on, we'll post that on our page today, that address. Again, if you missed it or didn't get it all down, we'll have it posted. Julie in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and for such an important program. And I hate to end sort of on a pessimistic note, but I'm wondering about the projected future of the DNR with regard to federal budget cuts and what we can expect and how are you all doing? And you're just a treasured resource, and I'd like to know, honestly, what we can expect and how we could help. Thank you.
I appreciate the sentiment. I think that's well above my pay grade, so I don't know that I'm qualified to comment on that, but I do appreciate the interest.
And there are ways that, for example, that the Bird Atlas and eBird, there are opportunities for funding to donate to those projects.
Yeah, that's right. We've had a lot. I mean, the book was essentially funded by sponsorships. We were auctioning off species. Each person could sponsor a species. So yeah, we've had a lot of contributors on that front.
Yeah, and that's been helpful. And so somebody else is wondering, when do you start on the third edition?
Well, 20 years, so 2035, we sure as heck better have the book done by then.
Well, I'm sad to say that I probably in 20 years from now will not be hosting the radio show, so we won't be able to, I won't be able to talk about it with you, but maybe hopefully somebody else will. In the meantime, Nick, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nick Anich, a conservation biologist with the DNR and coordinator of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, too. Great to have him with us today, and great to have you listening in today, and special thanks to our team as well. Producers Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, of course, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.